So very good morning, everyone. So as we begin the day, I'd like to encourage everyone to start this session by beginning to generate the right motivation, training your mind to rest completely free of all graspings and any tendencies that are dominated by habitual patterns of grasping, of craving. Generating the right intent that every effort that we create, every effort that we make in hearing the Dharma, in contemplating on Dharma, in allowing the essence and the meaning of the Dharma to be meditated upon, engaging in any practice that is in accordance with the Dharma, be directed with the motivation that it become all of this effort becomes a seed of happiness for all sentient beings. Within one's own mind, freeing oneself from this very tightness of obtaining, the agenda of obtaining, of getting something. Instead of a mind that is dominated by the habitual pattern of craving and grasping, of obtaining, of wishing to hunt something, of a result, of something to actually get for one's own self, allowing that thought to be relaxed, and instead generating a sense of wishing wellness, happiness towards all sentient beings. Again, if in one's own mind stream there is a dominating thought or a feeling, emotion of fear, of apprehension, of sadness, of worries, then again, relaxing that attitude a bit and concentrating in a transformed idea or a thought of truly wishing freedom from suffering of all sentient beings. Instead of a tightness that is dominated by grasping, arouse within oneself the first immeasurable quality of loving kindness, which is a thought of may all sentient beings have nothing but happiness and the cause of happiness. Whenever the mind becomes preoccupied by self and the sadness of the self, the worries of the self, the anxiousness and the apprehensions of the self, relax that thought a bit and instead simply shift your mind into replacing that thought with sympathy, learning from one's own experience and the habits of exaggerating a thought, most oftentimes unintentionally. Develop a sympathetic attitude that understands the same state and much worse of other sentient beings. Replace self-absorbed thoughts that are coated, tainted with suffering, to replacing them with generation of compassion. Giving out loving kindness, giving out compassion in thoughts, and instead of a preoccupation with one's own hopes and fears, allow oneself to relax into a state of equanimity, freeing your mind here with nothing other than a genuine joyfulness, joyfulness found upon the thought of having obtained this precious human existence. It itself is very remarkable. It itself is absolutely rare. It itself, this precious human existence, is so much endowed with many good qualities that I have obtained it today and have brought it to the path of Dharma, engaging in the Dharma, reflecting upon the qualities of the Dharma as you recite the morning recitation, which is all about seeing the qualities of the Buddha, seeing the qualities of the Dharma, seeing the unsurpassable qualities of Sangha, these three jewels, within one's own mind, finding the basis of happiness, of joyfulness, of being able to embody these precious qualities. And therefore, for oneself, equanimity and joyfulness, for others, loving kindness and compassion. When the mind permeates with that essence, with that understanding, when the exertion is put into cultivating this way of thinking, then throughout all activities, whether Dharma practice activities or mundane activities, the core essence of Buddhism, the core essence of all the teachings and the practices are brought and strengthened. So that is something one should always keep in mind. Let that be the basis upon which all hearing, contemplation, meditation and practice are built, and primarily carry that essence and reminder into the mindfulness of post-meditation engagements. So here we are, all of us, diverse backgrounds, different kinds of teachings, familiarities, and some new familiar ones, and some new to the path of practice. But each one of us engaged in this path of practice primarily for the simple reason that we wish to obtain enlightenment. Some wish to obtain enlightenment because, you know, it's a nice thing to do, it makes sense to do, something that is what we wish to obtain for our own selves. Some of that wish and aspiration of Buddhahood may be tainted with mundane aspirations and wishes, whether it is knowing something more, to become wise, to feel good, or whatever it is. In most cases, I'm sure that the motivation to obtaining enlightenment in Buddhahood is a pure aspect. Primarily, the purest form of aspiration is to obtain Buddhahood so that all sentient beings may find their own freedom from suffering, and the cessation of the causes that lead to suffering may be brought about through your obtaining of that Buddhahood. However, for most of us, since the ultimate state of attainment because of which we are exerting this effort into hearing the Dharma, effort in the years of practice, contemplation, analysis, meditation, and the effort that one puts into transforming one's attitude and conduct so that your living moments of your life are also permeating with the qualities of the Dharma. All of these different efforts that we exert is to obtain that Buddhahood. So there's tremendous giving of effort, generating of that effort into the obtaining of the result that we call enlightenment and Buddhahood. Now, if the result is Buddhahood and so much effort is being put, a meditator needs to often sit down and think about what is the resultant state actually. Because your understanding of what the resultant state is going to impact the exertion and the path that you are engaged upon. Today, when many meditators continuously, even after 20, 30, 40 years of practice, and of course the new ones also, have one common complaint. You love the practices, you don't have time for the practices, isn't it? So this is a clear indication that somehow the understanding of what the resultant state is still a little bit lacking. Because even if we say Buddhahood or the state of enlightenment or the realization of the absolute truth, whichever way you put it, meaning the same, we all may have a vague idea that it is a very good thing, pure state, that it is something that is incredibly beneficial for self and others, therefore obtainable. So in our mind, the predominant thought is, yes, what we would like to obtain is something that is what I would like to obtain. It is something that everybody wishes to obtain, that it is obtainable, not in the sense that it is possible to obtain, but obtainable in the sense that we all know it is a thing to be gotten, that it is worth trying to obtain that. And so when we all have this vague idea, of course, there is a lot of respect, there is a longing for that resultant state, but somehow, still, mind may not be able to really understand the truer qualities of that what we have to obtain. For example, there are some people who lose a job and then look for another job. I know some good friends of mine. They lose a job, they wish to find. Some seem to find a job immediately. Then some people I have been looking for a job. One person I know, I think now 93 was when he was looking for a job. Now how many years is that? I met him recently and I asked him, do you find a job? And he says, no, I didn't find a job. Since 1993, living with his mother, who's very kind to him, and possibly that's also one of the reasons. Isn't it? But what I do find is half-hearted approach to finding a job doesn't really make you find one. But when there is a person for whom it is a desperate need and you put your full focus into it and you don't mind what you get, but you really exert all your effort, then people do seem to, of course, even in difficult situations, find something. Now, there are some of you here, actually, good friends, who I know have lost a job, gotten a job 3 times a year. Seems very easy. So for me, I always think, why is it that for some it's so easy to find a job? Why is it that it is so difficult for someone to do that? And of course, the underlying, most oftentimes, the cause, underlying cause seems to be, is what you think is important for you, you do end up getting it. If you really think, look at relationship. If your antennas are all out, you will find someone. People with a relaxed antenna, then 100 people pass by and you don't really find anyone. Now, again, very funnily, I always observe within our Sangha, and it's always sort of sweet to know that whose antennas are alert. Even a weekend practice session, you find someone. So that's the, you know, effort that you put into it, because that thing I must get. And so when you put all your forces into it, it manifests. You know, the samsaric sense, relationship or job, what you obtain might not be what you want eventually. But nevertheless, what happens, what we are trying to look at is an analogy that we do bring into sort of supporting this idea that we don't have time to practice. And the situation here is we don't have time to practice because the resultant state is not something that you really know in its fullness, such that the importance, the profoundness, and its absolutely sort of essential essence not realized, there's an immediate relaxed attitude towards whatever it is that we engage in the form of practice. Otherwise, how does distraction become so strong? How does forgetfulness become so strong? How does not remembering the teachings become so strong? Forgetfulness, distraction, dullness, all the sort of negative neurosis or distractions, habitual patterns, sustain their strength because the strength of knowing the opposite is weak. And so, therefore, understanding the resultant state, knowing what Buddhahood did, becomes very important. From the Hinayana perspective, a true understanding of the state of Buddhahood as a pure state, which is the inner nature, the fundamental characteristic of my own personal self. For example, when we say, what's your identity? Who are you? What is your nature? These questions from a Hinayana perspective is, I am a pure person. My nature is pure. My identity is primordially pure. It is pure nature. But since such a Hinayana practitioner also sees that despite the inner nature being a pure person, pure state, pure being, however, it is hindered by all the neuroses, all the veils of ignorances. Therefore, the recognition of this, the resultant state of your own knowing yourself as a pure person, and at the same time, the contrast of our lives, and brought about, this contrast brought about by succumbing to all the negativities of ignorance, of desire, of anger, of jealousy, of hatred, of pride, arrogance. Therefore, the whole approach to one's own practices, eliminating what is negative, what is harmful, what taints and separates me from my own self, my true nature. And so the effort that one puts into through such a recognition is renunciation and revulsion. Renunciation of all the negative habits and revulsion to the habitual tendencies that are so very strong, that pulls us away and makes us unmindful, forgetful, lacking in awareness. Mahayana, through that same understanding, has tremendous similar kind of an attitude of revulsion and renunciation, but together with that has also a deepened understanding of how every one of us are in the same state, where each individual person's identity is so heavily bogged down by the influences of all the distractions, of all the neurotic tendencies, because of which each one of us live in this state of turmoil, of chaos. And so this morning, as part of my own personal practice, I was reading. Yesterday also I was reading the same thing. Today also I was reading the same thing, Guru Rinpoche's teachings. And in one of the Guru Rinpoche's teachings in the Pema Khatang, or the biography known as the Lotus Bone biography of Guru Rinpoche, he says, one of the marks of the degenerate times is an absolute trust in paranoia. That there will be more refuge in paranoia than a refuge into the calm, natural state of one's own being. That where a human being's tendency to make more sense out of a paranoia, wherever that is a dominant characteristic, one must know that the times are difficult. And it is true. There is nothing that actually today that makes sense, or we can live without a sense of paranoia. So, you know, look at the recent earthquake, for example. 30 seconds. Yes, it's an earthquake. But then the recurring things that took place after that. Look at the government, the economy today. It's based on paranoia. So where that paranoia, then we think, oh yes, being able to speak about such a paranoia is good. That makes you intelligent. The more you know about this paranoia, the more you can explain this paranoia, the more we can have a discussion on this paranoia, such as an intelligent person. And if a person says, what problem? Oh, this is an ignorant person. He doesn't know about paranoia at all. Same way in our own practices, Buddhahood has to be approached with a certain amount of paranoia, isn't it? Look at one's own mind rather than talking about somebody else's. How many different levels of paranoia? Hinayana paranoia, Mahayana paranoia, Vajrayana, of course, that's unsurpassable paranoia. So when that is sustained, mind has to then, the clear awareness has to then try and find untaintedness from that habitual tendency of paranoia to actually be able to rest calmly within one's own self. So Mahayanists have an understanding of this, and developing great sympathy progresses the same way as the Hinayana practitioners do, however, with a sense of community, sense of togetherness, sense of everybody being embarked on this journey, exploring this journey, finding the same challenges. Some fall back, some move forward. Having an acute understanding of this is the attitude of the Vajrayana, of the Mahayanas. Vajrayana also has the same attitude of wanting to realize through renunciation, through revulsion of habitual patterns and neuroses of this paranoia. But at the same time, there is the common sense of a Vajrayanist built from their profounder and deeper understanding of the Mahayana teachings, that this journey, which sometimes becomes so overwhelmingly complex and difficult and challenging, need not be so. And a common sense arises where you begin to say, it's not an outward journey. If it was an outward journey that required you to get somewhere, life is short, full of hindrances. Therefore, one may not be able to actually get there before life ends, or one is sort of discouraged by different circumstances. And the Vajrayanist common sense leads them to saying it's an internal journey. It's not an external journey. That what we are looking for, what makes renunciation so difficult, renunciation of the five root poisons so difficult, what makes revulsion to your own habitual, the sort of succumbing to the habitual patterns so difficult, need not be difficult actually, because gradually through years of practice of seeing them as difficult leads to the state of paranoia again. It's going to be extremely difficult, 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 difficult. You take refuge, it's going to be difficult. You generate bodhicitta, it's going to be difficult. You don't do anything, but it's going to be difficult. You know, some of you who are new have no idea what you're going to be doing, but you do know it's going to be difficult. So that's the paranoia there. So before starting off, your ego has let you conclude that it's going to be complex, it's going to be difficult. So throughout the journey, as you carry this paranoia into your path of practice, you do not retain the essence completely untainted by this paranoia of it being becoming very difficult. So Vajrayana is this wonderful method that allows you to really diffuse that by seeing that it may not necessarily be difficult or complex. It would be if it was something that was not yours, but others, and therefore you had to obtain it. You had to get it. You had to sort of pile it on your own self. But the Vajrayana teachings say it's based upon a simple choice. You either do it or you don't do it. It's actually that. Developing renunciation from the five root poisons, or you continue to retain them, it's a choice. Difficulty and the sort of existence and the relevance of that difficulty is only dependent upon your choice. You do it or you don't do it. Succumbing to habitual patterns, the domination of habitual patterns, is also dependent upon the same basis of choice. You allow yourself to be distracted, or you choose not to be allowed sort of into distraction. So the choice being so very important, whose choice is it? Vajrayana asks. It's not the teacher's choice. It's not the lineage's choice. It's not the Sangha's choice. It's not the choice of the sentient beings. It's your choice. How often do you have these choices? Every second you have 60 choices. Now, philosophically, we say every sort of a moment. Today, people say seconds or minutes and so forth, but we don't have that in the Tibetan vocabulary. So we say one moment. One moment, as simple as that, probably 1 second, can actually be very, if one looks at it in its very tiniest of its movement, can be broken into 60 parts. So probably you'd call it macrosecond or something like that. Then within such a moment, very tiny, tiny moment, quick moment, you actually have choice. And so it's not about, so the Vajrayana says, it's not about choice, 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 choice. So many of them, every moment you have to sort of make a choice. You could probably relax into having made a choice and making it decisive, such that the decisiveness of having made a choice can actually release its rigidity and separation of many moments into one pervasive space. So that would be choice, decisiveness, relaxation into that decisiveness, which is then called resting in the nature. So you see your mind able to make a choice of not being persuaded by the habitual patterns, developing a strong sense of revulsion to the negativities, and so sort of simply telling your mind, yes, these are, no matter how much I serve them. No matter how much I give in to the demands of my own neurosis, it seems to be unsatiating, unceasing. Therefore, at least for this moment, may I not move towards, may I not follow their demands and expectations, but allow my mind to have a sense of renunciation. Letting be is renunciation. Letting go is renunciation. And in this moment of having completely released grasping to responding to the neurosis of one's own mind, having made that decision, may I retain that from one moment to the next moment as long as I can carry it. And so this kind of a way of internalizing, looking at the choice, resting within that choice of not cultivating a sense of grasping and craving to all the movements, as we mentioned last evening, the inner and the outer phenomena, that's the Vajrayana approach. But all three approach, whether straightforward renunciation and revulsion, whether it is sympathetic renunciation and revulsion, or whether it is a decisive renunciation and revulsion, which is much more an internal state of abiding in samadhi within one's own self, what is today generally referred to as Hinayana approach, Mahayana approach, Vajrayana approach. All of these approaches, however, are directed towards then the ability to recognizing the state, the pure state, intrinsic of one's own self. Free from the root poisons, when one truly is able to recognize what one is intrinsically, who one is by one's own natural nature, what is one's own natural nature, that then is called the state of Buddhahood, that is then itself called the state of enlightenment. Now, in the case of Shakyamuni Buddha, in Lojen Rinpoche's teachings, especially with regard to the Great Compassionate One's preliminary teachings, teachings of the preliminary ones, within this, he does refer to it, and he says, 45 years that Shakyamuni Buddha spent in his whole life was 45 years of teachings based upon how a human being, an ordinary human being, could then understand that innate nature called Buddhahood. Through the 45 years, through his own enlightenment and the subsequent 45 years of teachings of the Buddha. Now, I think in some ways, historically, we say first turning of the wheel of Dhamma, second turning of the wheel of Dhamma. On the other hand, does it really need to be said so? It's a teacher's finding the essence of realization and taking 45 years of human life dedicated to trying to express what he found, what he actually realized, so that that shared wisdom could then allow others to also follow the path and realize the same essence. When we hear this, then we have to again bring to our own mind that all of us, what we try to engage, what we try to understand, are what the Buddha taught for these 45 years. But did he teach that for entertainment? Did he teach for 45 years for any other reason other than the attainment of Buddhahood? So those who follow his path of teachings must therefore have a clear understanding that when we are engaged in practicing the teachings of the Buddha, that it be led to the same attainment, to the same realization of the Buddhahood. So from this, the question would be is, are you practicing the Dhamma to attain Buddhahood or not? Of course, when we ask the question, your answer is yes. Why else would we do it? Second question, therefore, would be is, do you really think so? You know, when you say something like, when you go to the bank, pick up a carton of milk for me also. When you give errands to others, or you tell somebody who's going to a bank, you say, you know, your husband, wife, or Sangha member, or whatever, oh, you're going to the bank. Would you please mind bringing a carton of milk for me also? Picking up my mail also, for example. So in the same way, if we are saying, yes, we would like to attain Buddhahood, but while we're on it, then we'd like a little bit of entertainment also. You know, all the or arrogances of Buddhism, all the indulgences of Buddhism, all the spiritual sort of frills and different kinds of paraphernalia that are there. So if in one's own mind such sort of manipulations, again, of the ego-grasping mind, self-cherishing mind, is still tainted, then it immediately impacts the view, which is the resultant state. So when we talk about what is the resultant state, it is enlightenment, it is Buddhahood. Then the Buddhahood, the resultant state itself, is the view that we carry into our path of practice. So where the view and the resultant state both are based upon a foundation that is slightly being impacted and influenced by the same ego-cherishing mind, then immediately the path does become tainted by it, because of which sort of carelessness towards practice, distractions and dullness becoming predominant, inability to break through habitual tendencies, these different obstacles to the path of practice easily arises. Now here, when Buddha himself, having taught for 45 years, then the main thought in his own mind was, how could he condense throughout his 45 years of teaching? The main emphasis is, how could he bring every understanding that led to his realization brought into a framework, a basic framework that would enable people to progressively recognize this state of Buddhahood, that is the intrinsic nature within one's own self. And therefore we find that Buddha condensed them into what is called the insight, his entire insight into the framework of the Four Noble Truths. Noble Truth of suffering, Noble Truth of cause of suffering, Noble Truth of cessation of suffering, and the Noble Truth of the path of the path that leads to the cessation of the suffering. And so the common ground of all the Buddhist traditions, whether Hinayana teachings, whether Mahayana teachings, or the Vajrayana teachings, became founded upon the Four Noble Truths. So, and where many of the great teachers have said, where Four Noble Truths is understood, the understanding is clear and untainted, such a person has a very clear understanding of what the state of Buddhahood is. Earlier when we said, do you know what is Buddhahood? What is the resultant state that we are all trying to approach, because of which we are generating so much effort? Then such a clear and a truer understanding of the view of Dhamma and the resultant state of our engaged practices becomes more clear and true if the understanding of the Four Noble Truths is understood. Wherever Four Noble Truths is weak, the understanding of the Four Noble Truths is weak, then the entire approach to the Dhamma becomes weakened, because the Buddhahood, the resultant state, is also not understood. It is not understood because rather than eliminating the cause of suffering, ignorance, one's approach will be such, in most cases, where you sustain ignorance, where there is pride of the Dharma, then there is more sustaining of the same ignorance, although it is in the disguise of Dharma, where there is escaping into religion or meditation, where the fascination for the outer appearance of being a meditator is more dominant, then that again is more sustaining of an ignorance rather than the truer aspect of the Dharma. Let's say, one of the very unfortunate criticisms that spiritual meditators often have is that most who are spiritually inclined are social outcasts, isn't it? So misfits in society. Now, if that is from a much more sense of purer renunciation, then that's good. But on the other hand, if one allows the ego to actually be kidnapped by this, and because you do not want to make friends, you become a meditator. Because you find it so difficult to actually work, therefore you become a meditator. In the case of monks and nuns in the East, for example, most of the students, many of the students, quite a bit actually, who become monks and nuns at a young age, are done by two main things. which usually is presented as the third cause. Third is seeing the value of Dharma and the sort of nonsense of the samsara. That's the child also believes, and the parents also believe that that is the main factor. But underlying this good motivation are two main causes. The child doesn't want to go to school, isn't it? Doesn't want to really go to the main school. And the parents, because they've failed in their own spiritual path, have an agenda that the child does better than the parents. I would have liked to become a monk. I didn't, so I'm going to make my son a monk. You know, that kind of an attitude. So if we take that as an analogy, then, of course, why do teachers still agree for the young ones to become monks? There's always hope that you can let go of the negative motivation and something good can be replaced into it. Changeability of that is always there. And because of that, you know, a lot of the monks and nuns begin to get a training in Dharma. So one thinks, oh, even with the wrong motivation, something good will come out of this, if the mind begins to go through the changes. However, if that doesn't happen, if the change doesn't happen, then the sustenance of an ignorance, however, in the disguise of the spiritual practice, comes about. That's the key factor that leads to spiritual materialism. So spiritual materialism arises where, instead of the penetrative insight of the wisdom of the teachings dissolving and destroying all negativities, we simply transform that neurosis into a spiritual neurosis and sustain the same sort of negativity and the neurotic discursiveness. So instead of samsaric ignorance, it becomes Buddhist ignorance, and you dwell in that. That's spiritual materialism. Instead of having sort of abject anger, worldly anger, you become more patient, but you develop a spiritual aggression, competitiveness, fear, apprehension, irritation as a spiritual practitioner. Because of that, you have ended up outwardly becoming a practitioner, but the inner mind still sustains the neuroses. Arrogance, inability to really be friends with the others. So you become spiritual meditator, you go into isolation, into your retreats and Dharma centers and so on and so forth, but you retain that in the disguise of a spiritual practitioner. Self-cherishing attitudes, what you like for your own self. Mundanely, of course, it is easy to identify them as negative. But then now you put a prefix of it being Dharma. And then within all the appearances of a meditator, still, if the same self-cherishing attitude, what is good for me, what I would like to do for myself, this is how I would like to achieve, whatever it is. If those self-cherishing attitudes and the self's agendas are sustained, then outwardly it's hard to sort of not agree that, yes, you're doing a fair amount of practice, you sit well, you read well, your understanding of the language is good, you know many teachers, you know how to describe many different philosophies and theories and so forth. But since the mind continues to still indulge in the same kind of neurosis, the actual sort of discarding, the actual falling down of all the key root poisons does not happen. Where that does not happen, then fruition, of course, does not happen. Now, all of these situations, sustaining, although the appearance of the practices are there, but the sustaining of one's own neurosis, why does such an affliction, why do we begin to suffer such an affliction? How do we get into such a state? Is primarily because of not understanding Four Noble Truths. In such a practitioner's mind, if you look in one's own self, wherever you feel the influence of such hypocrisy and spiritual materialism brought into one's own mind, and you begin to address that issue, which is very important, you will find there's almost no sign of understanding the Four Noble Truths reflected in any practice that you do. You may meditate, but your meditation may be without a hint of even understanding the Four Noble Truths. any amount of profound philosophy that one may know, even let's say, those of you who've studied Mahayana Madhyamika, for example. Everything is a projection of one's own mind, essentially empty in nature, nothing to grasp, nothing to crave. We all know that. But do we carry that understanding within the understanding of the Four Noble Truths? Is it there? So when the Four Noble Truths is placed separately and the practices are placed separately, they do not come together, they do not touch one another at all, then what happens is you do the practices to sustain the ignorance. And therefore the cessation of the cause of unhappiness and suffering never really happens. So you don the armor of meditation, of all the practices and their learnings, but you increasingly enter into a field of many more enemies. Then it doesn't matter how much armor you have. You may wear double protection, double helmets, carry two swords or two guns in your hands. But if you keep increasing the adversities that you are meeting with, then there is no amount of protection that you can create for yourself that won't ultimately, you know, fall apart. And then the overriding factors of adversities in the form of increased emotions. Now you have two angers to deal with. Samsaric anger, spiritual anger. Now you have two ignorances. Samsaric ignorance, then spiritual ignorance. You have two desires. Samsaric desire, spiritual desire. You have two kinds of arrogance, samsaric arrogance, spiritual arrogance. So you have more increased number of adversities that one has to encounter. Therefore, the core essence of understanding Four Noble Truths, suffering. And what causes suffering? The first two Noble Truths must be kept in mind, truly engaging in reflection and understanding. Meeting with and wanting happiness must always be translated with the first noble truth of suffering. This is the state of happiness that I could experience, but what remains elusive for me and all sentient beings? The changeability of happiness should give us a much more thorough understanding of the noble truth of suffering. The all-pervasive happiness that could be, that never is something we are able to get, is a very direct way of understanding noble truth of suffering. That there could be pervasive happiness. Why couldn't there be pervasive happiness? Especially when 100 Buddhists are in one room, this room should be reverberating with nothing but an exhilaration of happiness. But doesn't happen. That's the absence of happiness, all pervasive happiness, which is within reach. It is graspable. It is there, but it is again fragmented by frowns and, you know, worries and anxiousnesses and preoccupation with wanting something. So rather than having that experience of happiness, staying within that enjoyment, that sense of joyfulness, you'd rather write down, we must get happiness. So this is the all-pervasive happiness obscured by all-pervasive suffering. And it's not that somebody is just throwing sand over our happiness, so to speak. But it's just because we do not know how it is. Our mind shifts to doing things that doesn't let it be there. So being able to really see, even in moments of happiness, when you get happiness, how changing it is, how fleeting it is, how fragile it is, how it is there and it is goes unnoticed by all of us. And we live our entire life not noticing those moments of happinesses that could truly be treasured. Noble truth of suffering. And then, of course, where does this come from? Where does this kind of sort of being deprived of what is very natural happiness so easily comes about? Is nothing but ignorance. It couldn't be anything but ignorance. And so when the Buddha realized it, and as Lojen Rinpoche says, as the Buddha realized, sat under the Bodhi tree, realized this, then he had to come up with an idea of How could he convey this same understanding to the others? Buddha had himself thought about all the different kinds of adversities that we go through, wishing the same kind of happiness, wanting happiness not only for himself, but something that he could find that he could share with those that he loved very much. Then finding that in his own enlightenment, as we create our own unhappinesses, it is so very much within our own reach, but simply through an ignorance of not being able to see that, we create hundreds and thousands of many different actions, causes and conditions that allow us to be more sort of sidetracked in sustaining those distractions rather than treasuring what stares right into our face, what is there at every moment. And so for all the sentient beings who are unable to see this very simple factor, in some ways what the Buddha realized was so simple, so very matter of fact, so very apparent. Yet, however, since, again, due to the ignorance, we become so far away, we move so far away from that simple understanding and become engrossed in creating otherwise a situation so more complicated, unwanted, but complicated and still something that we sustain. And therefore, knowing this to be the state of ignorance of all sentient beings through his compassion, 49 days that he debated on whether he should even try to express what he came to know or whether he should keep silent. Finally, with that understanding that perhaps something good could be imparted, and at, of course, at the request of all the of Brahma and Indra, all the other people, human beings who wanted to recognize, understand what he had found, he began to then teach the Dhamma, condensing it into the Four Noble Truths. And so this imparting of the Four Noble Truths, where Buddha then shares his realization by explaining that there is suffering, we are all within the state of existence of this immense suffering, simply being able to uproot the root cause of ignorance actually has the potential where each human being can find within one's own self freedom from all the unwanted unhappiness and suffering that one creates for one's own self. Of course, depending on whether you want happiness or not. Now, if somebody wants to really suffer, then it's okay. Now, we all smile when I say that. But if you look carefully, the predominant population of the world likes suffering. This paranoia that we spoke about, that Gurumuchi spoke about, is suffering. But it is something that we dwell in. And therefore, all the teachings do begin with. All sentient beings want happiness. Nobody wants suffering. It's to make us actually think, yes, happiness is a possibility. That it doesn't have to be necessary. It isn't necessary that one dwells in a state of misery, in a state of suffering. And so, Buddha's emphasis on suffering should be recognized as nothing but caused by one's own ignorance. Cessation of that, uprooting of that cause, leads to the cessation and the destruction of all the causes that lead to unhappiness. Freedom from unhappiness, freedom from suffering is obtainable. It is something that can be understood. Of course, on the other hand, many people, again, think of suffering as a very predominant teaching, and therefore tend to probably focus more on the suffering and the ignorance, making the journey of Dhamma very arduous, very, very difficult. However, that is then, I think, wrong way of looking at it. The most positive way of looking at one's own path of practice is the third and the fourth Noble Truth. Cessation is possible, and through the path of engaging in the teachings or through the teachings of the Buddha. Therefore, cessation can lead to, the path can lead to a state of cessation. And so in some ways, here is what is therefore, Lojin Rinpoche says, one of the most unprecedented teachings that can be found in the civilization of human beings is that the Buddhist tradition completely, and the Buddha's own realization in the form of his teachings, completely empower each individual to find enlightenment in one's own self. So it's one of the most liberating, one of the most freeing part of the practices, that your own freedom from suffering, your own obtaining of the state of happiness, ceased from all the impacts of samsara, realized state of Buddhahood, is not dependent upon anybody else but one's own self. And so here, three characteristics that the that Lochen Rinpoche puts into the teachings of the Buddha here is that of all the teachings that are there, the Four Noble Truth teachings, which he refers as Buddha's unprecedented discovery, are based upon three foundings. Freedom is possible. Freedom from samsara, freedom from suffering is possible. And therefore, in the minds, through the reflection of the Four Noble Truths, a strengthened understanding that this, what seemingly looks like a stagnant state of suffering, need not remain as it is. That everybody can have the opportunity, each one of us have the freedom and the possibility of not experiencing anything but genuine happiness, genuine goodness, that it is possible. Second, that each individual can make that freedom happen for one's own self independently. That one does not need to depend on anything, but each individual can exercise, feel empowered to be able to manifest all the required qualities of that freedom from suffering, that happiness is possible for one's own self, by one's own self. And the third is that this freedom from suffering is intrinsic. It is not external, and therefore it is not dependent upon any other factor. So no creator, no God, no other person, nor the Buddha himself, the Dhamma, nor Sangha, nor any, even the philosophy, eventually is something that is so important that it sort of is the origin of the freedom from the sufferings. Eventually, the freedom of the suffering is intrinsic of one's own self. Now, jokingly, I also say that perhaps this is one of the best news that we can get. However, after the best news sinks in, then we realize, oh, the bad news also, isn't it? And because of the bad news quality, Buddhism is never a very popular philosophy. There's not going to be an increased number. So I was just referring to this the other times that I was in some other center where the worry of this Sangha was so much on not having increased Sangha members. And so they constantly, as soon as we arrived, the whole of, sort of theme was, we've been here for so many years and still the Sangha remains small. It's not able to reach out to the other people. What can we do? So people try all kinds of these webcasting all these different gadgets and technologies that you use to outreach, empowering the youth, bringing the old people in, you know, making more monks. We try all kinds of different ideas. And I was joking with them, and I said, that's never going to be successful. Why it's not going to be successful is because Buddhism is never going to be a very popular tradition. Because even Lochen Rinpoche and Tedah Lingpa in his one of his teachings says, Buddhism makes sense to only somebody who's been through everything and has developed a sense of being blasé to all the levels of neurosis. And now, how many of us can actually come to a point where we become thoroughly fed up of anger, thoroughly fed up of grasping, thoroughly fed up of attachment, thoroughly fed up of desires? So I remember one of the conversations of two of our great teachers when they were talking about, oh, I'm fed up with this kind of grasping they were talking about. And this is a Tibetan way of saying this. You're filled up till here with something that you no longer have any kind of attachment to. So Dingu Kensa Rinpoche and Jebje Trigen Rinpoche were having this discussion, and they did this. So it's very much in my mind, the gesture that they had is that they were fed up with human human desires and so forth. Now, I wonder whether we've ever said that. I'm fed up with desire. I'm fed up with my laziness. So when that kind of, however, the whole point of the teachings is that you have to be fed up with your own neurosis, then Buddhism makes sense. Now, we're not fed up. We don't like it. But it's not that we're fed up of it. So what we'd like to do is take some of what we are not fed up with, leave those that we don't like, and then try to make sense of non-attachment, letting go, not grasping, selflessness, altruism, emptiness, and so on and so forth. So it's a very difficult situation. Coming back into the bad news here is that, yes, now we have no one to blame. Promptly, the Eastern Tibetans have blamed karma. Now we blame karma for everything. However, if you have a thorough and a correct understanding of karma, you can't blame karma, because karma from the Buddhist philosophical perspective is not destiny. It's not predestined. Everything is changeable. All karma is changeable. All karma are impermanent. The impermanent nature of karma, cause and effect, the changeability of karma, cause and effect, makes everything really within your own reach. You can't step on the accelerator on a hill, down the hill, and say, stop, stop, stop the car. Isn't it? You'll have to take your foot off the pedal. Hit the brakes. Or at least jump out of the car. Karma has to be understood as that. Destiny is where, you know, somebody else is driving and then you have no choice at all. Karma is where you have a choice at all the times. You're on the driver's seat. You're steering. You have control on the brakes. You have control on the accelerator. Now, however, the bad news is, no, you can't blame karma either. There is no God. There is no creator to blame. For all the mishaps, for all the misfortunes, for all the good things, and for all the positive things, there's absolutely no one but yourself. Your freedom is there. Freedom is possible. Each individual can make whatever one wants possible. It is your inherent nature, not dependent upon any external factors ultimately. And therefore, where the third and the fourth noble truth, especially cessation. Cessation is possible. Cessation from suffering is possible. Is an absolutely empowering and a freeing teaching and an experience. Nevertheless, we can't call it bad news unless we look at it in a wrong way. But nevertheless, the challenge does come into one's own self, is that you are therefore responsible for your own happiness, for your own unhappiness and suffering. And so while it is an empowering and a freeing, very independent approach to really being able to be responsible for your own self, one must also realize the enormity of trust as well as responsibility that is put into one's own self. So the empowering experience, liberating experience, must immediately be unified with courage, with awareness and sanity of being able to respond to it responsibly. Where the responsibleness, sort of the quality, is not completely uniting, that empowering, then you are empowered, but nothing comes out of that empowering sort of a realization. Therefore, here, in order to be able to really recognize, the Buddha himself said, in order so that one may be able to truly bring fruition to the cessation, one must understand the immense responsibility one has within one's own self to manifest that cessation. However, now in Buddha's own words, when he said, when the Buddha himself realized this, that cessation of all the suffering is within one's own self, if one could oneself learn how to relate to everyday experiences, how one would learn to really work with one's own mind, how much goodness and positiveness and causes of happiness that we could enjoy, that we could experience, is the fundamental discovery or the recognition that the Buddha himself had. Subsequently, these teachings of cessation and the path that leads to the cessation, a path that engaged upon, that reduces causes and conditions that bring about suffering, and through that, genuine happiness can be obtained, became the basis of all the Buddhist traditions. So the Hinayana teachings approach the same teachings. Mahayana and the Vajrayana teachings also approach the same teachings. And therefore, in some ways, as Lojen Rinpoche says, the approach of all the three vehicles are to understand the true nature of one's own self through that which one can then recognize how the cessation of all the ignorance and the causes of sufferings can be brought about. Now, all the teachings, of course, being founded upon the knowledge or the fundamentals of the four pillars or the four noble truth of the Buddha Dharma is there. However, Mahayana teachings predominantly approach this through the investigation known as the Madhyamika investigation of the true nature of reality, so that the cessation is better supported. Now, cessation would be is allowing the lessening, ceasing of all the negative causes. But then the Madhyamika Mahayana teachings say cessation to be brought about requires a far better understanding of relationship that you have to all experiences. Our experiences are predominantly related to two factors, our relationship to the external phenomena and our relationship to our inner phenomena, the phenomena world of emotions, sensations, feelings, thoughts, and so forth. And so Mahayana teachings try to better the relationship with the outer phenomena and the inner phenomena so that the cessation, which simply means elimination of the causes that impede the realization of one's own true nature, to be better fruition. And so most of you are very familiar, but here in the Lojen Rinpoche's text, he says, great masters, beginning from the great panditas of the second century, whether it is Nagarjuna, followed by great masters such as Chandrakirti, which many of you are now studying with Khonkro Rinpoche's teachings, now explore mainly the theme. They explore mental and physical things and conclude predominantly three things. Nothing exists absolutely, nothing exists independently, and nothing exists in isolation. So the theme, now here we are talking about path and cessation, the third and the fourth noble truth. In order to be able to really understand and bring about cessation, the path of the practices that the Mahayanists walk upon is in trying to understand the relationship of oneself with the outer and the inner phenomena. And in examining this, they find three things: that nothing actually exists absolutely. Does it exist absolutely? We think it exists absolutely. And thinking things exist absolutely makes us rigid and uncompromising. And so the attitude that brings about unhappiness can be found in a rigidity so strong, so uncompromising, that it becomes dominated by demand constantly. So when the attitude of uncompromising in one's own self is found, as meditators, of course, one of the most essential things is to engage it in one's own experience. Whenever you find it, whenever you find in your own self an uncompromising attitude, a rigidity, a stubbornness, arrogance, that kind of a rigidity and an uncompromising attitude is founded upon what basis? And the basis is that you firmly believe that things do exist absolutely, and therefore you can place and actually find common sense in your demand, in your rigidity, in your own stubbornness. Things do exist absolutely. Therefore, I need it. Therefore, this is how I want it. Therefore, this is what is on my agenda. So we begin to immediately make more strong a stubborn attitude, a rigid attitude. Madhyamika Mayanists again also say, nothing exists independently. Now, to the subsequent talks as we go into, then we are going to talk about what is not existing absolutely or independently or in isolation. But here, just to keep it very simple, Mayanists again say, nothing actually exists independently, like an island. But everything exists in codependence with one another, that they are all interrelated, that we are all related for everything. Paturumuchi, as he says, even for a glass of water to be here on the table requires no less than at least a dozen people who have worked. Then if you go into the whole purpose of where the origin of the water comes from, then you'll have to include more than 100 people. So the interdependence, collectiveness of participation of many different factors, when not understood, we begin to think, no, things exist independently. So which is wrong. And so as the teachings say, things do not exist independently. When this is not understood, two negative factors come up. Unkindness and indifference. And so wherever the mind thinks, oh, things exist independently, we may not say it in so many words, but when the firm belief, the wrong view, is there in our own minds, then we begin to say, oh, I don't care. The indifferent attitude towards sentient beings comes out of that. Because we think, I am me, you are you. Your happiness is your happiness, it's your business. My happiness is my business, therefore it is important. And so a sense of unkindness because of the self-importance, and an attitude of indifference because of not caring for the others, not understanding the interdependency of all each one of us, therefore sustains these two negative tendencies, negative habits. Third is, again the Mayanists say, things do not exist, whether mental or physical, in isolation, alone, as single thing. Wherever one begins to assume that things do exist in isolation, it immediately breeds arrogance, ego-grasping, self-cherishing attitude. And where, yesterday as we talked about, is that the linear view of the self becomes so dominant that it completely engulfs even the needs of the others, the presence of the others, the living livingness of the others, the aliveness of the others. And so if when one looks at it, we may not say table exists in, for example, those of you who have studied Madhyamika, we all know table doesn't exist intrinsically. We all say table is composed of many different factors. Table has lumber in it. Table has different kinds of nails and different kinds of wooden in it. People have to plant a tree before it became a tree. You know, it was so and so forth. We actually cannot see this as much as a table, as a, let's say, a bug can see it as its home taken away from him. You know, so there are all of those different ways to look at what things do not exist independently. This is what the Madhyamika teachings talk in terms of breaking away the solidity of different structures, of different forms. However, now we're not talking so much about tables and chairs. We're talking about how much of that understanding did not actually get incorporated in our view of what is most relevant to those factors that bring about causes and conditions. What creates causes and conditions? Table? Yes, to some degree, but maybe 0.5%. 99.5% of your causes and conditions is not the poor table, it is your attitude in life. That attitude and interpretation of life that becomes sort of manifest in your conduct of body, speech, and mind. And if the conduct and the attitude carries a sense of uncompromising rigidity, stubbornness, if the attitude and the conduct carries within it unkindness and indifference, if the attitude and the conduct carries this sense or this flavor of arrogance and self-absorption, then exploring critical analysis of where you found, what is the basis of such unkindness, arrogance, rigidity, stubbornness, pride, or self-absorption, or indifference, you will find is a firm belief that mental and physical things exist absolutely, independently, and in isolation. And so, otherwise, where would you place such a thing as, this is what I like, this is how I like it, this is mine, this is yours, I don't care. All those very smart statements that we make, that we assert, because of which we create a sense of me versus you, those are all founded upon a firm belief. And so here, therefore, all the great masters have said, as long as such a mistaken view is maintained, cessation does not happen. That ignorance is the ignorance of such a belief. And therefore, in summarization, what we are talking about is, suffering arises because of ignorance, the ignorance of not knowing things as they truly are, and that is further sustained by not knowing codependency, interdependency of sentient beings, the bigger picture of how much we are all interrelated to one another, not understanding that, imposing just the self and the bigness of the self that completely dominates awareness of reality, the understanding of the true way how mental and physical things evolve. And so this all piles up into creating enormous energy, causes and conditions of unhappiness and suffering. Because how long can that, you know, the nature of interdependency is in its own sort of pathway manifesting constantly. It is the natural truth. But we are trying to sustain an opposite sort of an approach. An opposite approach of trying to defy the logic of changeability, of interdependency, by asserting our own rigidity, our own stubbornness, by asserting our own indifference. We're all dependent, but we're all going to continually assert a sense of, I'm an independent island. Nothing to do with you. So sometimes, I don't know how much it happens here, but in the East, we have a lot of times when people say, people are not my friends. A lot of times people say that. I don't have many friends, or people are not friendly to me. So in a polite society, we always have to find some reason to say why people are not friendly to you. It's the bad karma of the sentient beings who do not see what a nice person you are, kind of an example. But that's not an honest answer. Answer is that you can't have friends if you're not friendly. So this is a simple sort of an example of knowing codependency. You do not want to be lonely, but you're going to be arrogant. Nobody is going to want to live with arrogant, aggressive, rude, unkind person who is indifferent to your own happiness. And then you keep wondering, I'm living among all Buddhists, but they're not sort of becoming my friends. I'm still very lonely. I feel isolated, people say. You will feel isolated. Because here the interdependency is not being understood. All sentient beings within samsara, there is this common change of relationship, common link that we all have, where we share with one another. Where that is not understood, you assert a false view, that is the rigidity. And so people say things like, this is how I am, take it or leave it. That's a sort of very strong assertion of the stubbornness in the attitude. In the same way, unkindness, where there is no kindness, where there is all preoccupation of the self alone. But then on the other hand, then you are trying to find a theory of kindness somewhere. So irony of a person who breeds, compassion. It's kind of really, really very unfortunate, where you sit and everybody breathes out light and warm breath of kindness and happiness, and may it eliminate all the sufferings of the other sentient beings. You breathe in all the sicknesses and the dark smoke and so on and so forth. And then the person walks down to the dining tent. A marvelous manifestation of, how dare you do this? Why is this not like this? Why are you sitting there? Why do I have to look at you? I don't know whether you do it, but this is how most probably it is. Because this is what happens most often. Would you mind not shutting the door when I want the fresh air to be here on the mat? I am meditating, can't you see? This is my rock. those sharp retorts, strong statements, rude behavior. Maybe it's not a very polite thing to say, but some of the things when you all do, when I watch you all go into the porta potties. Not even the simple sense of courtesy. Someone waiting, someone who might want a cleaner space. So long as you can do it, you can get your space, you can have your own thing. When those kind of things happen, now what we are pointing out here is the three negative things that are pointed out, where there is a sense of rigidity, wherever there is unkindness and indifference, wherever there is a sense of uncompromising attitude, arrogance. All of these have no basis of sustenance until your mind has begun to slowly have a firmer belief of the solidity of things rather than understanding their true nature. Here the point is, Buddha would not have expounded the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, and particularly emptiness and the 12 interdependent origination, the core teachings leading to the Prajnaparamita teachings, if he had not seen this to be the cause, not understanding interdependence, not understanding the Four Noble Truths to be the cause, the main cause that led to the manifestation of suffering. Where does suffering come from? Suffering comes from an arrogant belief. Suffering comes from indifference. Suffering comes from unkindness. Suffering comes from someone's, my own, arrogance and self-cherishing attitude. Otherwise, where would suffering come from? Therefore, suffering is there caused by this ignorance. Cessation must and will happen when the cause is eliminated. That's then the first teaching of the Buddha himself. He himself, Buddha himself, when he realized this, the first thing, the joyfulness of his enlightenment came from what is then here known as, what Lojen Rinpoche says as, the ability to free oneself from the domination of the ego. Secondly, the ability to free everything else from the domination of one's own ego. Two things. So the Buddha himself, when he found this answer in his enlightenment, it wasn't an external enlightenment. It wasn't something new he began to find. But what he found, his joy, the joy of his own recognition, realization, was in the profound realization of these two, is that since all seems to be caused by that ignorance, letting go of that ignorance, the dominating factor of this ignorance, he could actually be free from the domination of the ignorance, because things are not in isolation, not independent, not externally existent. Knowing the three absolute truth, the three findings, which later the Madhyamika Mahayana people teach, which we just went through, that things are not absolutely existing, things are not in isolation, that things are not independently existing. When that realization arose in his mind, the joyfulness of knowing that he did not need to be under the domination of the ego, and more so that he was able to free all others from the domination of ego, relating, and therefore in that way it is said, the peacefulness and the joyfulness of the enlightenment arose in a way of being able to now have a much more healthier relationship to things. So our relationship to every phenomena, whether it's our own thoughts or whether it is to the external phenomena, retains being unhealthy, because we are unable to give it the freedom of what it is. The domination of the ego imposes our own indifferent attitude, our own unkindness, our own selfishness, our own expectations, our own hopes and fears. And therefore, the whole relation becomes completely sort of built on a ground of struggle, of competitiveness. Where one understands the beauty of gatheredness, togetherness, the sense of expansive sort of interdependence of every other factor, that happiness is not an independent thought, so many things go into creation of it. Suffering is not to be blamed on one factor, there are so many things that go into the creation of it. As I always say, the example of understanding the cohesive codependency of all other factors is when, even in the mundane terms, when we say, such as when we say the thank yous at the end of the retreat, for example, it's always a very sensitive thing. You cannot imagine, some of you have not done this, how much thought goes into the thank you that ultimately we all decide we are going to say thank you everyone. Because when you don't do that, you leave someone out unintentionally. And so when you leave someone out, there's bound to be hurt feelings. People don't express it always so much. People are always kind. They say, oh, it's okay, you forgot me, that's not a problem. But it is a problem. And so when things like this happens, it is that the sadness or any kind of hurt comes when everyone is not appreciated. When someone is said to be more prominent, someone less prominent. For example, when you say, thank you, Rinpoche, for this and so on and so forth, I feel very bad, because speaking for 2 hours is the easy thing. The most easy thing, whether there or here, I would be talking anyway. Isn't it? So that's the easy thing. But whatever else goes into the creation, when that is disregarded and people associate a possibility of your practice only with the teacher, then that is again a fault. That is not considering the wholeness of every situation, everything, and participation of everyone that goes into the creation of that whatever we are experiencing. Such a similar kind of a thing is the lack of understanding of interdependency. Where the codependency, interdependency is not understood, we begin to focus upon only the resultant state. You like it or you dislike it. So it's so easy to walk into, let's say, any kind of a situation. For example, when you go into any kind of a walkway these days you have, where many artists are working, painting or doing certain things, and you can look at them. And people who know the least about art will walk through and say, I like that. Well, that's bad. This is not good. That is not good. And that is an absolute disregard for the amount of work, energy, effort everybody puts in. If you looked at that, you would never be at a point where you could discriminate and say one was better than the other. When it comes to effort, when it comes to input, how can we say this is good, this is bad? How can we say this is pretty, this is not pretty? Ugly and beauty, for example. Oh, you're pretty. Oh, you're not pretty. Those very discriminating, arrogant decisions, always the cause of hurt and bias and partiality, come from a lazy mind that is unable to really know and understand the cohesive coming together of everything else. So, therefore, here the teachings do say, unkindness, arrogance, indifference, rigidity, stubbornness, these are all that which spoils our relationship to everything else. When that relationship with the phenomena and your own feelings becomes spoiled, become bitter because of a very biased and a judging mind, you have no other option but to learn Buddhism to become a kinder person. How sad is that? Really? The saddest thing about religion, sometimes I feel, is that you have to resort to a spiritual philosophy to become a good person. There really cannot be a bigger dampener to your ego than that, in actuality. But here we are, nevertheless. So when the Buddha did realize this, the first thing, the basis of his own happiness and joyfulness of his realization, it was in the fact that his relationship to everything became much more easier, more kinder. And so we say three things that did arise from that is that the Buddha felt that he did not have to cultivate a kind of a, what do you call, enmity or an antagonistic attitude towards the phenomena. So the relationship with inner and outer phenomena became non-antagonistic. Secondly, that you were not a protagonist for every situation. And third, that there did not need to be a competition with every phenomena. So the three major things is non-competitiveness with the phenomena, inner phenomena as well as the outer phenomena, sense of release of the ego that assumes that it is the protagonist in every situation. And wherever anything goes wrong with that, that there has to be a sense of being sort of in enmity or an antagonistic attitude towards situations. Three main things that spoils our relationship with every experience, intrinsic of our own self, towards our own mental attitudes, as well as towards all outer experiences and physical entities. And so it is said that when the Buddha began to really find that he could liberate himself from all of these attitudes or for all of these wrong misunderstandings or misconceptions, that liberating attitude, that freeing experience became the basis of being able to rest in the samadhi meditation of equanimity. How does equanimity arise? If we look at what samadhi or meditation is, it says rest in equanimity. State of equanimity is explained in two ways. One, equanimity that is reached through being impartial and unbiased. And second, an equanimity in discovering your own basic nature free of grasping and craving. Now, if we take time to look at it, what are these two approaches to equanimity? Actually, we find that it is what here we have just spoken about, is that you remove the protagonist, the sort of antagonistic attitude, the competitive attitude, and what you discover is a much more open, expansive ability, possibility, that is at rest, that is at peace with whatever arises. That then is the natural samadhi, that is the natural state of meditation. And so when that becomes more permeating, pervasive within one's own self, that then becomes closest to one's own fundamental nature. So noble truth of cessation, the third, arises when this is understood. So the general, what is the path of practice? Path of practice that leads to the cessation of ignorance is in being able to then eliminate the enormous grip of the ego that assumes everything has to revolve around its own demands and expectations. But that cessation, that cutting through, cannot happen until a thorough understanding of your relationship to the phenomenal world is not understood. So a healthy relationship to things must be developed. You have to have a healthy relationship to your own feelings, emotions, sensations, mind and mental actions or mental patterns, thoughts. You must have a very healthy relationship to the phenomenal world, to other sentient beings, to the animate and the inanimate phenomena. So cultivating healthy relationship becomes essential. Now, how do we do that? How do we cultivate a healthy relationship? Therefore, in terms of teaching a path of practice, of course, the Buddha's first announcement was the first three noble truths. There is suffering, cessation is possible, it is dependent upon you, and cessation leads to the uprooting of all the sufferings. But having made the three announcements, then he had to formulate a path of practice that would enable us to realize these three announcements of the first three noble truths. And so the path began to be articulated by the Buddha in two major traditions or two major points or principles. So these are what are often called the two essential principles connected to the Buddha's teachings on the fourth noble truth of path, which are then said to be the first one, the philosophical view of understanding of interdependent nature of reality. Now, second is the principle of compassion, which is action derived from the view of the nature of reality. Once again, the first is the philosophical view of understanding of interdependent nature of reality. Now, what does this mean? First is mind beginning to analyze, have a critical analytical approach to understanding the law or the view of interdependent nature of reality of all phenomena. To simplify it, you could say it is emptiness, the view of emptiness leading to compassion. Understanding the nature of emptiness, the result of which is nothing but natural compassion. Second principle is the principle of compassion, which is action derived from the view of nature of reality. So what does this mean is that where actions, engaging in actions of compassion, not just practicing compassion, but a compassion that is felt and understood to be supreme through having related to the first principle view of emptiness, through an increased understanding of the view of the nature of reality, the heart is able to practice compassion in action more. So this then could be simplified into saying compassion leading to emptiness, or compassion leading to unfabricated emptiness. So ground basis of both the approaches are the dominant key approaches to Buddhist teachings. Now, those of you who are new and you say, what is Buddhism trying to teach? Then you will say, Buddhism tries to teach these two approaches. Through the understanding of what the nature of reality of phenomena is, it builds in you a deeper, healthier relationship. Call it compassion. But what is compassion? It's a very good relationship with everything. And at the same time, it also teaches parts of practices that are engaged in that compassion that allows you to make sure that your understanding of the emptiness, the true nature of the reality of phenomena, doesn't remain just a theory, an intellectual idea, but that it is completely incorporated in all aspects of your own living, body, speech, and mind actions. So these two are the approaches which today are now known as Hinayana approach and the Mahayana approach. The Hinayana approach leading to Mahayana is predominantly in the first principle of really understanding the interdependent origination that allows you to really have a thorough and a more accurate understanding of things as they truly are. Mahayana approach is, while being able to pursue on this understanding of interdependency, there is also engagement in the actions of kindness, actions of compassion, which allows you to making sure that this understanding of emptiness is true, very genuine, and not something that we are telling the world, but not practicing our own selves. So these two being the two main approaches where the Buddha then said, or he gave the path of practice. So when we say, what is the fourth noble truth, the path, then these are the two paths, two approaches to the realization of the first three noble truth. These two paths, particularly the first one, the approach to understanding the true nature of interdependency, is the basis upon which refuge is taken. So when you take refuge, there is the sense of determination to finding the truth. So when we say, what do we mean by taking refuge? Refuge is often said to be the entrance of Buddhist teachings. You become a Buddhist practitioner. Taking refuge must be correctly understood, because that is how you begin to engage in the path of the practices. So the refuge, the essence of refuge, is said to be determination to finding the truth. What truth? The truth of the nature of reality as they are. To find the true nature of phenomena. To find the true nature of your own mind. To find the true nature of who you are, who is relating to this existential world. And therefore, the determination to look for the truth is the refuge. So the first part of the practice is philosophical view of understanding interdependent nature of reality is engaged upon by first taking refuge. Second, the principle of compassion, which is action derived from the view of the nature of reality, is then taken by engaging in the bodhisattva vow. Generation of compassion is the essence of taking the Mahayana vow, also called the bodhisattva vow. And so bodhisattva vow, just as refuge is determination to finding the truth, then the bodhisattva is the compassionate approach to finding the truth. So when you say, what is the meaning of taking the bodhisattva vow? The answer would be is, it is to still strengthen that refuge vow, but to do it more compassionately. A compassionate approach to discovering or finding the truth. So therefore, in order to be able to realize the four noble truths, especially the first two noble truths, and bringing about the third, cessation, engaging on the path is by taking refuge and taking the bodhisattva vow. Now, taking refuge is in the text simply defined as laying the foundation of the individual practitioner to live within the to live a life within ethics that avoids harming others and within the view of the law of causality. So, having taken refuge, generating the determination to finding the truth, what is the first step? And so the teachings say, the first step is to lay the foundation for the individual's, practitioner's, way of living life that is led within ethics. And what is ethics is? Ethics that avoids harming others and within the view of the law of causality. What does that mean is, with an acute sense of mindfulness that allows one to be aware of causes and conditions, the power of causes and conditions that impacts one's own life and the lives of the others. summarization of this. Now, since it is very abstract, the theory is very abstract, it is summarized as the Eightfold Path, cultivating right view. Cultivating right view means, what is right view? Right view is a view that is very knowledgeable and aware of the law of causality, interdependent origination. Clear understanding of cause and effect. Clear understanding of interdependent origination, codependent arising. Right thought. Right speech, right action. Where the view, the first rightful path, permeates your thoughts, translates and is manifest in speech, and all your bodily actions carry the essence of your understanding of the right view. Now, what does that mean is, before you make a decision, you do understand the power of law of causality. You understand causes and conditions. Before you say something, there is an awareness and a mindfulness strong enough that allows you to really know the impact of your speech, good or bad, because of that understanding of cause and effect, how it can cause something. Before you actually think of an idea, that you are able to have an acute sense of understanding of causality, interdependency. And because of that, there is an ability to exercise wisdom of mind that discerns between things that are good, useful for the others, doing them. Things that are negative, harmful for others, not doing them, eliminating them. That then is the essence of refuge. That is the essence of actually engaging in a path of practice. Now, in most cases, sometimes, unfortunately, we do find is that meditators from all different aspects are good meditators. If somebody says, how are meditators today? All of us are good meditators, trying very hard. No complaints, especially about the diligence and fondness for practices. Good amount of devotion also, maybe. But on the other hand, what is lacking is right mindfulness. What is missing is right thought, right speech, right action, because of lack of right view. The predominant, what most important quality that must be evident in a meditator is mindfulness. But that mindfulness cannot just be mindfully there. It has to be mindful of the right view. And the right view is power of karma, power of cause and effect. My doing this creates this. My not doing this creates this. My saying so will impact in such a way. My this action is going to impact the lives of the others. Conscious awareness of the power of causes and conditions that you create, brought together with a stronger discerning wisdom that eliminates what needs not to be done, what is a cause of unhappiness, strengthens, encourages you to create more positive conditions. That's the core quality that is needed in a meditator. Where that mindfulness, where that right view, right thought, right speech, right action itself is missing, then remember one thing. No matter how much you meditate, nothing much will happen. One of the great masters, Drukpa Kunle, very controversial figure though, has said, between samsara and true practitioner, he says monks and nuns, but today we'll just have to say true practitioner, there is another middle group confused, never able to be samsaric, nor able to be totally nirvanic. But this bulk of the confused being has immense pleasure in this life and immense suffering in the next. And that's who? This middling group, bardo beings, is us. We. Are we samsaric? Not really. You've taken 21 days away to be here. So you're not going to enjoy those 21 days as a samsaric person might do. We could be in, what did we say always? Bahamas? No, Hawaii. So we could be there, isn't it? But we're not there. Instead, we're going to be braving a hurricane and meditating in small tents, which you never know when it'll fly off. Isn't it? You're going to eat food that you don't like. You're going to sit where you don't like. You're going to sleep in places where you don't. You're going to particularly make yourself quite uncomfortable. So it's not really pleasure of samsara. So we stay away from it. Now, is it totally nirvanic? No. Because we're going to complain. We're going to be arrogant. We're going to be upset. We're going to be fearful. We're going to be very neurotic. So it's not going to be a totally nirvanic experience, enlightened experience either. So we are stuck in the between. And as he says, it's a very pleasurable spot to be in. Because whenever nirvana calls, you can jump into the side of the samsara. So if I tell you, you know, you have to be totally free from bias, partiality, anger, fear, do not get angry, as I went through last evening. And of course, everyone says, what happened? One of the reactions, whenever I'm laying down some kind of rules, don't do this, don't do that, people always think, okay, who told her something? You always become suspicious that something went wrong. Nothing went wrong. It's my responsibility to say that to you. But on the other hand, if I do so, then you all say, oh boy, she's been living with nuns all her life. She doesn't know who we are. We have all families and jobs and so on, you know, jobs and families. If I tell you, you're here, revulsion is very important, renounce the world, you're immediately going to say, my mother, my father, my children, my boss, my colleague, my job, my responsibility, my debt, you know, all of those different things, you're immediately going to jump into samsara. Isn't it? Now if I tell you, you cannot come for this because you are all samsaric. You won't be able to keep this commitment. I'm going to be giving out this empowerment or transmission, which I will give to only very serious practitioners who have some qualities of, then the miserable feeling of, you know, why aren't we being discrimination? These Tibetans are all about discrimination, you know, because I'm a man, because I'm a woman, because we are Westerners, because they are Tibetan, see how they are partial, see how, you know, you all come up with all those kind of things. And that's where you jump from samsara into nirvana. So it's very entertaining. Very entertaining, and it's, you know, you can sort of maneuver. It's like getting addicted to those video games where you are trying to race an imaginary car. You know, you take the right turns, and it goes this way, and it goes that way, and, you know. But at the end of life, never having made a decisive decision, sort of being very, very superficial, but also conniving in many ways. And so at a certain point, however, when causality strikes us, causes and conditions strikes us, then there is the manifestation of a resultant state is uncompromising and is based only on the causes that are created. So when that actually arises, tremendous suffering is something that one encounters. The sustenance of all of those deceptions and continued subjugation of the ego's domination leads to the situation in experiences of difficulties and suffering to one's own self. Therefore, in order to be able to really bring about a sense of not giving into this deception or hypocrisy, but truly encouraging oneself to embark on a journey, on a path of practice, which is honest, cultivating mindfulness that watches your body, speech, mind is absolutely important. Therefore, in order to know the true nature of reality, the doorway is through cultivating right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, the fifth, right effort, sixth, right mindfulness, seventh, right concentration, eighth. So the Eightfold Path, which is became the basis of why it is called path, began to be expounded by the Buddha himself. So the Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth that the Buddha taught, path that, if cultivated, leads us to bringing about cessation of ignorance and the causes of suffering. Now, in cultivating the Eightfold Path, however, we do come into encountering the most basic hindrances, and that is how much we do not know phenomena, how much we do not know interdependency, how much of this subjugation of the ego is there, because of which our mind again and again creates causes and conditions of unhappiness, is further understood. So diligently walking on the path of the Eightfold Path gives us a much more acuter experience of all the things that we spoke about. Then self-grasping attitude becomes most apparent. The indifferent attitude becomes most apparent. How much we have begun to think of ourselves as very independent of the others becomes very, very important. How much we lack in the understanding of interdependence becomes most important. But for it to become very sort of apparent and very clear to us experientially, engaging in the Eightfold Path becomes very necessary. In the same way, the second engagement in the generation of the Bodhisattva vow. And here the text says, engaging in enhancement of compassion, which aims to generating mind with a commitment to helping others. And so in that way, the Mahayana teachings incorporate 37 practices of the Bodhisattva as the path that leads to building a much more deeper and an accurate sense of relating to the existing world, to all the apparent phenomena. Just as Eightfold Path creates a challenge for us that addresses the issue of how lacking we are in the understanding of interdependency, likewise, 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, the Mahayana teachings, engaging in them completely makes us more clear in our understanding of how much we lack an understanding of interdependency. Doing the 37 practices is kindness, compassion in action. And in engaging upon the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, we have a deeper realization of how dominating ego is that does not allow us to understand that things are not as they seem to be, and how important it is to understand the cohesive compositeness, compoundedness, interdependency of all phenomena. So in this way then, the three, these two parts are the most fundamental parts of the practices. So when we say, I am a Buddhist practitioner, basically this is what you are doing, is that you are taking refuge, cultivating the Eightfold Path, trying to understand interdependent origination. As a Mahayanist, you are engaging in the Bodhisattva vow, with which you then engage in the 37 practices of the Bodhisattvas. And again, leading to the same is understanding the fundamental nature, law of causality, interdependent origination. So these are the two approaches that are there. The approach of the first one, refuge. And what does refuge mean? And leading it to the understanding of law of causality. So that's the next chapter, next subject. So I'll go through that during after lunch.